Red Ice Radio. Thank you very much for tuning in today. I'm glad to have you with us. My name is Henrik Palmgren. We are currently coming to you from the west coast of Sweden. And if you want to know more about our radio program and what we do here, head on over to our website, redicecreations.com. That's R-E-D-I-C-E, creations.com. And today we have Lon Milo Duquette with us, and many of you who are interested in the esoteric will be familiar with this name, of course. He's an author of many books on the subjects of magic, the Western magical tradition, the tarot, alchemy, Enochian magic, Aleister Crowley, sex, Kabbalah, and religion. His latest title is called Enochian Vision Magic. Lon is also the host or co-host of a very interesting DVD series called The Great Work that I've been watching over the last few days. This series is from the producers of the underground classic Magical Egypt, the DVD series, Chance Gardner and Venisi McNeil. There's other people popping up in The Great Work as well, like John Anthony West, whom we had with us a while back, but also Georgia Lambert, John Michael Greer, Art Rosengarten, Pamela J. Smith, and others. And we're going to talk a little bit more about The Great Work, alchemy, and the tarot later in the program. I also want to mention that Lon has, since 1975, served as a national and international administrative officer of the OTO. That's the Order Templo Orientis, for those of you who don't know. That's one of the most influential and controversial magical societies of the 20th century. And since 1994, he has served as the Order's United States Deputy Grandmaster. So if you have time later today, this is something that I'd love to talk more about as well. The website you should visit is lonmiloduquette.com. That's lonmiloduquette.com. That will give you more information about his books, DVDs, seminars, and workshops, and so on. So with that, welcome to Red Ice Radio, Lon. It's great to have you with us, and thank you for spending some of your time with us here today.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
It's great to have you here. As I mentioned, I really enjoyed the great work, seeing some of your research and material coming up in that series, and explained in a very, very, very nice way, produced by Chance Gardner, of course, who put that series together. But before we talk more about that and some of your books and the OTO and so forth, I'd like to, if you don't mind, Lon, if you could just share with us a little bit about how you first became interested in magic, Aleister Crowley and the Kabbalah, and even the tarot. It's always interesting to hear how people get involved in these esoteric subjects.
Well, I guess we could start by saying I'm a child of the 60s, a flower child, an aging hippie. I got interested in human consciousness. I guess we could lump everything into that term, back in the mid-1960s, when I came in contact and had several remarkable and influential experiences with LSD and psychedelics. And I, up until that time, I was more or less a Midwestern materialist, and I didn't have very much interest in spiritual matters per se as I was growing up, but I always considered myself sort of a spiritual explorer. Yes. And part of my exploration, as soon as I graduated from high school and came out to California to go to college, was with the psychedelic phenomena, and it more or less, I don't want to bore you with I saw God on LSD story, but it more or less told me that human consciousness was a far more wonderful and the fact that learning about myself was going to be the only endeavor worth pursuing for the rest of my life, and that that was a springboard into Eastern mysticism, which was you know, popular with the Beatles and everything. And,
right.
And so I sort of dove in to the deep end of the pool of Eastern mysticism and sort of fancied that I would gain enlightenment with a nice shaved head and sitting in a full lotus. But it was sort of strange. I imagined myself losing my ego and becoming completely enlightened, but I did it in such a way as I thought I would look really cool really cool losing my ego.
Right,
you know? And so it was, I sooner or later came face to face with the fact that in a very real way, the Eastern mystical method and the Western mystical or magical method, the goal is the same thing, but the process is completely different. So I came to the conclusion that I was trying to play Eastern mysticism software on my Western hardware.
Yes,
you know, it just wasn't working out, and so I went on a kind of a frustrating quest for a few years to find something in that resonated with my Western psyche, the same way that the Eastern psyche resonates with things like the Tao Te Ching and the wonderful concepts of Tao, of the Tao.
Yes.
And so I was looking for a Western Tao. And for a while, I wasn't coming up with very much. Christian mysticism, at least for me, contained or brought with it a lot of unfortunate baggage self-loathing and guilt and all of those nasty things. And I'm sure it doesn't have to be that way with everybody, but with my particular background, it did. Mm. So I finally started to get a clue when my brother joined an organization called Rosicrucian Order AMORC.
Right.
AMORC. And you've seen them advertised in Popular Mechanics in every magazine in the world, you know, what secret powers did these men possess? And so I thought, well, that's probably a pretty corny thing. But if my brother was interested in it, and he said they're sort of like mystic Freemasons, only they had women.
Right.
So the woman thing. You know, so, oh boy, mystical Masons with women. And
was that the attractor, you think, then?
I've been married my whole life, so it had to have been only a vicarious attractor.
I see what you mean.
But do
you think, Lon, that you wouldn't have gone down this path if it wasn't for your experiences with LSD and other psychedelic drugs?
I can probably say yes. Okay, and I certainly don't want to encourage people to do anything illegal or foolhardy with their brains. But I tell you, I needed a real something very dramatic to pull me out of the base material. I was a jerk. Okay, it took something very dramatic. It took literally a religious experience par excellence to show me that there is so much more to the human mind and so much more to the universe than just going to school, getting a job, getting married, getting sick and dying.
Right, right. And do you think that also joining the Rosicrucian Order and later on, I guess, then the OTO as well, has that helped to enhance that and propel your spiritual journey in that sense?
Yes, it gave me the discipline, kind of the step-by-step discipline that that I needed to move forward with this this growth process. I truly have nothing but good things to say about the Rosicrucian Order, and they showed me that I enjoyed ritual work. I enjoy taking these inner concepts that I dealt with inside myself during my years of working with Eastern mysticism, and it showed me how I can project these inward things outside of myself and start dealing with them as if they were objective things. So dealing objectively with subjective concepts is sort of what magic is. And I learned that I learned I had a passion for sacred ceremony. I learned that that I really enjoyed putting on a robe and strutting around in the dark.
Right.
And not only that, but
is that what it is? The rituals, if you know what I mean. Yeah. Is that what it's implying here, or is it more, obviously? I understand that there's more beyond this, you know.
No, of course there's more beyond that, but it gave me the feeling that I could enter into a sacred environment that was outside of myself as inside of myself. I sort of put two and two together that there is no outside of yourself, and that things that you do seemingly on the outside, you're doing on the inside too. And it's one of those, I guess, Kabbalistic illuminations that, people shoot for. But I found out that I resonated very well with that. Not only that, but the degree structure, the initiatory degree structure that my Amorc experience introduced me to would later come in very, very handy when I started to see and study the degree, ritual degree work of the initiatory society, such as the Golden Dawn or Crowley's OTO, mm-hmm. or AA. And so it was a wonderful, wonderful training ground for me. Eventually, naturally, because I was a young man and impatient and brash and irreverent, eventually I sensed that the Amorc pace was going to be pretty slow. And I started to poke around with other things. And I took this marvelous correspondence course by an organization called Builders of the Adytum, mm-hmm. or the BOTA. And they had a Kabbalah tarot correspondence course. And I'd never been exposed to the tarot, and I didn't know what it had to do with the Kabbalah. And for about 3 years, I took their marvelous correspondence course, and I learned a great deal about the tarot from a Kabbalistic point of view. And so it was like my boot camp, my training ground for Hermetic Kabbalah. Hmm. And
what would that, this? Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say my passion for the Kabbalah, my passion for the tarot cards, and my involvement in the Rosicrucians all sort of dovetailed together one afternoon when I was at the South Coast Plaza Shopping Center here in Costa Mesa, and I ran across a deck of tarot cards in a beautiful box. And the back of the box had a beautiful drawing of the rose cross, the hermetic rose cross on the back. And I said to myself, this is, gee, I'm into the Rosicrucians. I like that. I'm into tarot cards. I like that. Tarot cards are into Kabbalah. I like that. And I, the name of this tarot deck was the Thoth Tarot, or T-H-O-T-H, however you want to pronounce that.
Right.
And, I, even though I didn't have, you know, much money, I bought that deck and I took it home and I opened it up. And I was freaked out. The first of all, the cards are indescribably beautiful. But at the same time, they're really weird. And they weren't like any tarot deck that I'd ever seen before. And they were kind of scary. And the colors were very disturbing in some of them, and the images were very disturbing, not because they looked particularly evil or anything, but they were so breathtakingly strange that it was disturbing to me. And I looked at that fool card, the very first one in that deck, and this guy looks truly crazy, and he's got horns, and he's got, doesn't look like he's got eyelids, and there's strange web-like perspective threads that dominate the background, so you don't know whether you're being pulled in visually to the cards or whether the cards are projecting out at you. They require your mind to go to dimensional places that your mind usually doesn't go to when you look at tarot cards. So I was disturbed a bit, and I thought, you know, these cards are so beautiful that I think they're so beautiful and captivating that it was almost like the devil drew them.
But this is the Thoth Tarot deck, that's the one by Crowley, isn't that right?
That's the one by Crowley and Frieda Harris.
Yes.
But I'd never heard of Crowley before. I never heard of any of this. But the only thing I can compare it to is in the 1800s, there's this marvelous violinist, Paganini. Okay, Paganini could play the violin better than anybody in the planet. He could make the violin sound like no one had ever made the violin sound before. And his contemporaries and other musicians who were jealous of this immense talent, said no human can play that beautifully. He has to have help from the devil.
Right.
And so he overheard that one day, and he thought, oh, I'm going to have some fun. And so he started showing up to his concerts being delivered in a hearse, and he'd wear a wild black cape, and he really had fun with that that superstitious thing. Well, when I looked at that Thoth Tarot deck, it was almost like this is too magically beautiful. And in my youth, in my superstitious youth, I had that idea in the back of my mind. Maybe this is just so beautiful that only strange supernatural forces could have went into its creation. And then I looked at the side of the box, and it said Aleister Crowley, created by Aleister Crowley. And the name sort of rang a bell, but I didn't know what it was. And I had a little occult dictionary that I had bought at the supermarket about a month earlier. Really, at the grocery store, near the checkout, they had like make your own sushi and how to play bridge and occult dictionary. and it's just like a pamphlet, you know. And I I got that out, and sure enough, I found the name Aleister Crowley in it, and it said, Aleister Crowley, famous Scottish Satanist. And I went, oh, boy. Oh, man. You know, I was right. The devil made these. The devil created these cards. And so I had a little crisis. I had a little freak out. I had a little nervous breakdown. And I put those cards back in the box. And the next time I talked to my brother says, oh, I bought a book, you know, a couple years ago that I think is the book that goes with those cards. He says, I'm not afraid of the cards. Give me the cards so they'll go with that book. And so I gave my brother those cards and I said, good riddance. And a week or so later, a good friend of ours who I write about in my autobiography, My Life of the Spirits, it's a magical friend. It's a friend that pops up in your life about every 3 years and changes everything.
A physical friend, or are we talking about a spiritual friend?
Okay. Yes, a physical friend, but physical friends are angels and spirits too, you know, in their own way. But anyway, Mad Bob had been in Guatemala growing mushrooms or something exciting and illegal. And we hadn't seen him in about 3 years, and we hugged, and we said, what have you been up to? And I said, well, I'm really interested in the Kabbalah and tarot and initiatory societies and stuff. And I really am having a good time with my magical career here. And then in passing, I said, oh, by the way, I really dodged a bullet there. I had this tarot deck by this Satanist guy, and I almost got sucked into using it. And Bob said, you know, what Satanist guy? And I said, well, Aleister Crowley. And then Bob looked at me like I was the stupidest person in the world. And I knew he was thinking that because he said, you're the stupidest person in the world. And he said, everything that you think you want to learn about this Kabbalah and about this Hermetics and about this mysticism and this magic and this Western tradition, everything you want to know and want to learn, this guy knew more than anyone on the planet. And I said, well, but it says he was a Satanist, you know, was he a Satanist? And Bob says, no, he wasn't a Satanist. And then he thought for a second, and then he says, well, yeah, he sort of was. Right. And then he changed his mind again. He said, but no, he's not a Satanist. And finally he said, look, if he was a Satanist, he was a good kind of Satanist, and you are just going to love this guy. And so I said, okay. And Bob made me promise that I'd get those cards back and that I would borrow my brother's book, which is called The Book of Thoth, one of the last things Crowley wrote in his life. And in that book, Crowley does indeed try to explain everything he's learned and experienced in magic in the 72 odd years of his life. And that was sort of my introduction to Aleister Crowley, and it was several years. It took me several years to completely feel comfortable with the fact that the man really led a very eccentric and wild and crazy life. Mm-hmm. But he was brilliant beyond. He truly had no peer as far as a modern, 20th century. Magical mind was concerned, and that's what got me on the path to a formal study of Crowley's works.
So in your studies, you've been studying Crowley now for a long time, and again, this is a question that many people again come up against as soon as they pop you know, come up against his work, so to speak, and there's different sources, as there always are, to, you know, that this is the most evil man that ever existed. Some say he's the most influential person of the 20th century and so forth. But do you feel that the man, Aleister Crowley, still is either black and white like this, or is he more a shade of gray? Have you been able to define him more, so to speak?
Well, I would say he's a very brilliant shade of gray. Absolutely. You know, first of all, I don't want to excuse or apologize the man's shortcomings. He certainly did have shortcomings. He was a human being. He was, he had as many flaws and shortcomings as you or me or anybody else. But you can still be a very human, very flawed individual as far as relationships with other people or peculiarities of character and relationships and such, and still be a bona fide holy man. One of the, I like to use the example of Sri Ramakrishna for people who are familiar with the great Eastern yogi, holy man, guru. He was the guru of Swami Vivekananda, and more or less the heart and soul and creator of what in America we call the Vedanta Society, which is, you know, formal Hinduism.
Right.
And you read of stories of Ramakrishna, and he was not your stereotypical guru. He would he would buy drugs for his disciples. He would flaunt eating meat. He had relationships with women. He did things which may not seem to our 21st century sensitivities very, very wild and crazy, but for the image of a standard guru in India, the guy was a wild loose cannon. Well, Crowley was similar to that, only Crowley had Crowley's brilliance even would blind himself. He was so brilliant intellectually that he could not fathom that everyone else wasn't almost as brilliant as he was. It did not occur to him that people could not tell when he was joking or when he was being facetious or if he was being outrageous for the sake of shocking people out of their spiritual complacency. And he figured everybody was catching on to what he was doing. And the fact is that hardly anybody was catching on to what he was doing. A good example is people accuse him of being a cannibal. Even today, people say, well, Aleister Crowley ate people.
Right.
And well, first of all, I'll start off by saying, no, he didn't eat people. he was on a mountain climbing expedition. You know, he's a world-class mountaineer. Some of his records still hold today.
Right.
And he was on a mountain climbing expedition, and when they were organizing the climb and organizing the party, they're in the foothills of wherever it was, Nepal. They were forced, the only porters that they could, that were available for them to hire, Sherpas, I guess we could call them Sherpas, but they're porters, were a team of men who the year before had mutinied, against, they'd been hired by, I believe it was a German party of climbers. And about halfway up, when the going got tough, these guys murdered and left to die the German party. Hmm. Okay. These guys were, would you want to hire these guys to climb, you know, with you?
No.
But they were the only people available, and, you know, people plan and save money and prepare for sometimes years for these climbs. And if the weather's bad, they go and do it. And if the only Sherpas you can hire are the people that killed their bosses last year, you got to hire them. So they hired this roughneck crew of porters, and Crowley figured that he could keep them in line. And they run into difficulty, weather difficulty, and everybody is grumbling, and they want to go back home. They're all thinking it's too dangerous to go forward. And as sort of a diversionary tactic, Crowley takes two of them and scouts out ahead for the next day's climb. And there's this classic image of these ice bridges, you know, that span this hideous chasms and abysses,
right.
You know.
Yes.
And as it turned out, the two men that he took did not follow his instructions and concerning one of these ice bridges, and they fell to their death. Now, Crowley was in a predicament where he would have to go back to camp with all these other guys that were already experienced in killing their bosses, and go back and tell them that it was so dangerous up ahead that two of them already were killed. It was an almost impossible situation. Crowley had to go back and tell these guys information that would make them mutiny and kill. Okay, it was horrible. Mm-hmm. And Crowley, in his perverse wit, went back and didn't mention the fact that the other two were missing. And when the rest of the Sherpas questioned him about where these other two were, Crowley said, "I killed them and ate them." Hmm. And it was such a weird thing to say. I think he probably pulled a revolver on them, you know, as he said that. But they were so freaked. And there's in their superstitious mind, they looked on Crowley as some kind of a wild demon, and the party returned home safely, okay, and they didn't mutiny. Word got out that Crowley had confessed to killing and eating two Sherpas.
Right.
When he gets back to India, they're interviewed by members of the Alpine Club, which were very kind of jealous of Crowley's independent party's climb. Reporters ask him, is it true, Mr. Crowley, that you killed and ate two of your Sherpas? Now, in Crowley's mind, no one in the world would believe that he killed and ate two Sherpas. So just for fun, just facetiously, he said, "Oh, of course I did."
Right.
And I guess everybody there giggled, or most of the people giggled and knew what was going on. But by the time that reached the newspapers, mm-hmm. Aleister Crowley killed and ate two Sherpas. And he enjoyed that absurdity so much that he continued to, when people ask him, he continued to laugh at them and say, "Oh, of course, what would you have done?" kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's just kind of one example of how Crowley is underestimating the public at large with his wit. Of course, he didn't kill those guys and ate them, and he felt bad about it. And he writes about the incident in his Confessions. And another another more exotic rumor was that that he wrote in black and white in Magic and Theory and Practice in a chapter called The Bloody Sacrifice. Talks about this a sacrifice of a male child.
Right.
And he's in a footnote, he said that his records show that he'd done that 120 times last year, or 1 year he did that. And of course, he's got other footnotes that says, you know, that when an adept says one thing, he's probably saying another. And in another footnote in that same chapter, he all but says in so many words, please don't take what I'm saying literally here.
Right, right.
Okay, so what he's talking about in this bloody sacrifice chapter is he's talking about sex magic. And in 1923 or 4, when this chapter was written, it was not not only not proper, it was not legal to talk about certain explicit sex acts. Even people in medical journals had to be careful about how they breached that topic. And so what Crowley was saying, and he thought it was clear to absolutely everybody that knew where he was going with this line of discussion. What he was saying was that in that given year, his records show that he ejaculated 120 times without making a woman pregnant.
See what you mean? Yes.
And so he was doing it in such a way as to offer very advanced sexual magical techniques in theory. But doing it in a way that people intelligent enough to be interested in that subject in the first place would know exactly what he was saying. And not only that, in such a way as they'd get he'd get a smile out of them, you know. But I tell you, when he wrote that, not everybody was laughing. And today they still quote that as proof that he confessed to doing that. The truth is, Crowley never did anything, was never arrested for any crime other than those involved in bankruptcy.
Well, that's quite a way to veil that type of terminology. It's to bring it up another notch, so to speak.
Yes.
You know, it's. But do you think that Crowley, like in one sense, didn't ultimately didn't care about what anyone else thought about this or what he was doing? I mean, he was doing his own thing in that regard, and it didn't really care about how other people would interpret this. Do you think that was the case as well?
I think Crowley, in his first 50 years, didn't care what people thought. As a matter of fact, let them think what they want.
Right.
But I think as he matured and in the last 20 years of his life, when he realized that his work had really been damaged by this cavalier attitude, and that people weren't reading his books, he wasn't having the ability to attract disciples. And so I think especially in the last 10 or 15 years, he truly regretted all of those I guess, indiscretions of attitude. Hmm. And I think he would have just loved to have been accepted in the world of spiritual exploration, in the same way as like Aldous Huxley or,
right.
Because he was of that caliber. And so it was sad. It was sad in a way. And we still enjoy the outrageousness of his behavior, in the early years. But as it turned out for Crowley personally, it was a bit tragic.
Hmm. I want to go back a little bit to Crowley's tarot deck as well, and ask if you've been able to kind of, I guess, in one way, figure out why you were so drawn in by this deck, or what it was about the particular composition of these cards that kind of triggered, if you will, this feeling in you when you look at them.
It's a fascinating subject. I took 3 years and wrote, I guess it's back in 2005 when I finished. I wrote a book called Understanding Aleister Crowley's Thoth Tarot. And it's a pretty thick book, and I don't know if I or anyone else in the planet, that was back in 2003, it was finished. Mm-hmm. I was more or less recruited by members of or people at New Leaf Distributing and Wiser Books to write an extended commentary explanation that might be suitable for people to try to figure out what Crowley was saying in the Book of Thoth and with his Thoth Tarot.
Hmm.
And so, but I went ahead and with the project, and it took me 3 years. So it's called Understanding Aleister Crowley's Thoth Tarot, and it's been translated into German. I think that's the only language it's been translated in so far, and where I try to explain this. Frieda Harris was Crowley met Frieda Harris very late in life. He was in his late 60s and she was in her early 60s. And she was an avant-garde artist. And she was a disciple of disciples of Rudolf Steiner.
Right.
And she was also a theosophist and a co-mason. So she was interested in everything Aleister Crowley was interested in. The Golden Dawn had long before dissolved. So she was, and she met Crowley in the 36, I believe, 36, 38. And they met at a party with other eccentric people. And Harris, of course, knew Crowley by reputation, and Crowley and Harris was smart enough to not be afraid of him. And Harris more or less approached Crowley and said, in so many words, "Look, you're approaching your 70s here, and your health is not all that good. You're going to die pretty soon. I think you should write a book that synthesizes all of your accumulated knowledge and experience in the magical arts. And I think you ought to organize that book along the lines of the tarot, kabbalistically." And Crowley said, "No, that's not a, that's too much work."
Right.
He didn't want to do that at this stage of his life because it's just too much work. And but he counter-offered Harris that she could just touch up and redo a more standard like gypsy fortune telling tarot deck and just tweak it a little bit, and that he could write the kind of like the little white book that comes with every deck of tarot cards, and that they could split the money. And at the time, Crowley was an undischarged bankrupt, so he didn't even have control over his own assets. So he had to had to think up these little projects, you know, to make money under the table. And they went back and forth and back and forth, and Harris finally came back with an offer that she would join his AA and his OTO, and that she would formally become his magical student, and that she would pay him a weekly figure to teach her magic, and in the meantime, he would write that book, and she would illustrate that book with 78 full color watercolor paintings. Mm. And Crowley, that was an offer Crowley couldn't refuse. And they started the project, and they thought that it would be through in 6 months. And, of course, it took, 6 years? And they had to do it all through all the inconveniences of World War II. Yes. And the bombings and the Blitz and all of that.
Yes.
But you ask what makes these cards so weird that it makes you feel like you're being pulled into it, or that they're jumping out at you, and this thing that requires your mind to switch kind of to another dimension, is really, she set out consciously to do that. And she did it through a process that, a technique, a graphic technique that, kind of the brainchild of Rudolf Steiner, and they called it projective synthetic geometry. And if you'll Google that, you'll see examples of how it's expressed graphically, and it looks like webs. If you like, take a grid of rubber bands, and then stick your fingers in the rubber bands and stretch them out one way or another. That's an example of projective synthetic geometry. And I don't pretend to understand it. I'm a simple man. And when you get that abstract, you kind of lose me. But one of the explanations of, at least theoretically, of synthetic projective geometry, you can say it both ways, means the same thing, is that in regular Euclidean geometry, if you draw a circle and you put a dot in the very center of the circle, that the distance, the radii, when the point is in the circle, the radii, if it's in the very center, the radii are equal lengths.
Yes.
And if you move the dot away from the middle, the wall it comes closer to, the line is shorter, and the wall that it moves away from is longer, and the other radii along the arc, right, of the circumference also change in their relative lengths.
Yes.
But in projective synthetic geometry, the idea that the point and the circumference can occupy the same positions simultaneously. Don't ask me to explain that, but using these lines and grids and manipulating them, just like you see in the background of, say, the High Priestess card in the Thos Tarot is a wonderful example. And how if you, the same grid pattern, if you go to the Queen of Cups and you put those two images head to head, they create one single magnificent array of these web-like grids. And so the literal, she consciously went out of her way to give you an experience that when you look at the dimensions and the perspective in the cards, it is different than the perspective and dimensions of the rest of the room that you're in.
Right, right.
That's around that.
Yeah.
That's around that card. Mm. And so it does a thing to your brain. And I'm sure someone far more knowledgeable than I could suggest what it does to your brain. But it is really something very, very special, very, very advanced. And Crowley just loved that kind of stuff. Mm. And thought that would be the perfect artistic vehicle of visual expression of his ideas. And Crowley's main revelation in all of his work is this idea that the age has changed, that we have these he saw them as the dynamics of the age changing as the interplay, the development of well, he calls them for convenience sake the goddess Nuit, mm-hmm. the star goddess, the goddess of infinite space, and her lover, her counterpart Hadit, who is consistently the point within her very center.
Yes.
And so, again, using this image of a circle with a point in the middle of it, that one infinity of universe, not only of space but of consciousness, could be symbolized by this infinitely expanding circle. And Nuit, the star goddess that has all of the infinite stars within her body, Nuit would be symbolized by that circle.
Yes.
And Hadid would be that abstract conscious or concept of the dimensionless point. She's the big big, and he's the big small. And he's always in the center of her, but she's expanding. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so that both infinities are infinitely everywhere. So the, if the circumference is infinite and the point in the center is infinite, they are both infinitely everywhere.
Yeah.
And on one way of looking at them, they're making love. Infinitely. And this is the great lovemaking process that causes the vibration, if you will, that makes the field of operation for the universe to manifest as. Hmm. And that vibrating field of manifestation is personified as Ra Hor Kuit, or their child. Hmm. And to have this artistic concept that deals with infinite circumferences and infinite centers, to have this projective synthetic geometry being the vehicle, the artistic, technical, hands-on technical vehicle for Crowley to splash his cosmic principles is just the perfect combination of art and spirituality. Hmm. Crowley and Harris were a match made in heaven.
Well, it's really beautiful. I like that rendition, and especially artists who can, I guess, help us to transcend in that way, or to see another if you will, dimension that really isn't there in the 2D plane, but actually in one sense is created within us as we're watching this, if you know what I mean. It's really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. And you said the book is called Understanding Crowley's Thoth Tarot. Is that correct? That
yes. You're writing Understanding Aleister Crowley's Thoth Tarot. Mm. And it's published in the United States with Wiser Books. And Isis Urania, I think, is the German publisher.
Mm. You know, Lon, I think this would be a good place to round things up here for the first hour. And we certainly would love to continue talking more with you in our member section about, I'd like to go into a little bit more about some of the material that you address in the DVD of The Great Work about the difference of the elements and even how actually the tarot are divided into this quaternity that you talked about, and even how this, of course, these four categories of things can be are eventually crowned with, if you will, the fifth element, with the quintessent, and tie the knowledge of the tarot, I guess, a little bit together with alchemy and even psychology, if we end up in that place. But I do want to mention here before we round things off that the great work, the DVD that you're featured in, is available through magicalegypt.com. And we got an email here from Venice that told us that those who listen to Red Eyes can actually type that in the coupon code box, and we'll get a 25% discount. So that's really, really nice of Chance and Venice to do that. So again, people can head over to magicalegypt.com, and simply when you purchase The Great Work, you can type in Red Eyes, REDICE, in the coupon code box. And so beyond that, Lon, please go ahead and mention your website again for people who want to check out more of your work and a few of your other book titles as well.
Oh, well, my website is my name, lonmiloduquette.com, and no spaces. And for people who are on Facebook and MySpace and Twitter, I'm there too. I've got quite a few books. The one that's been translated into the most languages so far is one that I did about the same time as the Understanding Crowley's Thoth Tarot. It's called The Key to Solomon's Key, Secrets of Magic and Masonry. And that one has been very popular, and it's in quite a few different languages too. And then if they're interested in Aleister Crowley, I wrote The Magic of Aleister Crowley, A Handbook of the Rituals of Thelema. And I have a tarot deck called The Tarot of Ceremonial Magic, and a book that goes with that. But if the listeners are just kind of interested in just taking a peek into the life of a magician and what this is all about in sort of a anecdotal form, I have my autobiography is called My Life with the Spirits. And if someone is just going to test the waters of Lon Milo Duquette's magic, I really encourage them to read My Life with the Spirits.
Very good. And again, these titles are available on lonmiloduquette.com, and we will have this link up on redicecreations.com as well, so you can click through easily from our website. But let's take a break right here, Lon, then, and we'll return and talk more in our member section. But thank you very much for being with us. We'll be right back after this break. Thank you very much for listening. We are going to talk more with Lon Milo in our member section about Enochian magic, initiatory societies, secret societies, magical orders, Freemasonry, and the OTO. But we'll begin to go into some more detail about Enochian magic, talk about some of the different systems and what the purpose is for learning and studying some of these techniques. Head on over to our website, redicecreations.com, click on subscribe, and join us in the members area to tune into the second hour. We'll take a short break right here, listen to some music, and then we'll be back with more.